her to close all her open applications, log out of the system, and then log back in so I could determine whether she could access the operating system command line interface. Once I confirmed she could, I asked her, "Please type set password." She would then be looking at a prompt reading old password. "Type your old password, but don't tell me what it is." And I gave her a gentle lecture about never telling anyone her password. At that point, she would be looking at the new password prompt. By now, I was dialed in and standing by. "Now enter Pactel 1234, and when you get the next prompt, enter that password again and hit enter. The instant I heard her finish typing, I logged in with her username and the Pactel 1234 password. Now for multitasking in split brain mode. I was feverishly typing away, entering a 15-line program that would exploit an unpatched VMS vulnerability, then compile and run it, setting myself up with a new account and providing the account with full system privileges. Meanwhile, through all of this, I was simultaneously feeding instructions to Melanie. "Now, please log off your account. Now log in again with the new password. You got in okay? Great. Now open all the applications you were using before and check to make sure they're working the way they should." "They are? Fine." And I walked her through the set password process again, once more cautioning her not to tell me or anyone else the new password she was setting up. I had now gained full access to Pactel's VMS cluster, which meant I could access customer account information, billing records, electronic serial numbers, and much more. This was a major coup. I told her how much I appreciated her help. It wasn't as if I was home free now. I spent the next couple of days finding out where the CDRs were stored and maneuvering for access to the customer service applications, so I'd be able to probe at leisure to find the name, the address, and all sorts of other information on every phone account. The CDRs were on a huge disk, storing near real-time data on every call to and from customers in the LA market for the previous 30 days or so, a bunch of very large files. I could search right on the system, though every search took me something like 10 to 15 minutes. Since I already had Eric's pager number, that was my entry point. Had anyone on Pactel called Eric's pager, 213-701-6852? Of the half dozen or so calls I found, two jumped out at me. Here are the listings exactly as they appeared on the Pactel records. 213-507-7782-0-920-305-0028-15-213-701-6852, Los Angeles, CA. 213-500-6418-0-920-304-1953-19. 213-701-6852, Los Angeles, CA. The 213 numbers at the beginning of each line are the calling numbers. The number groups starting with 9-2 indicate the year, date, and time. So the first call was made on March 5, 1992, at 28 minutes past midnight. The first calling number was one I recognized. It was the phone number on Eric's rental application, which I already knew was listed in the name of one Mike Martinez. Once again, this was a huge red flag. I had thought Martinez was just a phony name for Eric. Or Eric was a phony name for Martinez, but now that didn't make sense because Martinez wouldn't be calling his own pager number. So whom else had Martinez called and who had called him? I ran a search on Pactel's CDRs to find out. It wasn't any revelation that he was calling the FBI since I had stumbled on that information after I got his phone number from Eric's rental application. Quite a few of his calls were to and from other cell phones provisioned by Pactel. On my notepad, I jotted down the numbers. Then I started examining the phone records for each of those accounts. All of the numbers on my list belonged to people who were in frequent contact with one another, as well as with the FBI's Los Angeles office and other law enforcement agencies. Oh, shit. I knew too many of these phone numbers. The office number and cell phone of Pacific Bell Security's Terry Atchley, a manager of Pacific Bell Security based in Northern California, John Venn. Also Eric's pager, voicemail, and home phone numbers, and the numbers of various FBI agents. Their direct phone numbers all began with the same area code, exchange, and first extension digit, 310-996-3XXX. This last group made it pretty certain that Martinez was an agent himself and helped me put together a list of the other agents probably on the same team. The other call to Eric's pager that jumped out at me had come from 213-500-6418. My search of that phone number proved to be a gold mine. There were quite a few short calls in the evenings to a single internal FBI phone number. Likely explanation? The guy was checking his voicemail. I dialed the number. "This is Ken McGuire. Please leave a message."
"Who the hell is Ken McGuire, and why the hell is he after me?"
I hit the zero button, expecting it would take me to a receptionist. Instead, a lady came on the line and answered, "White collar crime, squad 3. A couple of innocent-sounding questions, and I had another piece of the puzzle. Agent Ken McGuire was on the Los Angeles FBI squad, referred to as WCC3. He was probably Eric's handler. This had become a fascinating adventure. By the end of my lengthy traffic analysis, I had put together a list of people at the Bureau who were in regular close contact with the agents and support people I now figured were trying to take me down. Shit. Who else would have had the balls to investigate the FBI at the same time the FBI was investigating him? It was all coming together, and it was looking like stormy weather ahead. I felt I was past the point of no return, but I wasn't going to give up without a struggle. 19. Revelations. We're told that our medical records are confidential, shared only when we give specific permission. But the truth is that any federal agent, cop, or prosecutor who can convince a judge he has legitimate reason can walk into your pharmacy and have them print out all of your prescriptions and the date of every refill. Scary. We're also told that the records kept on us by government agencies, Internal Revenue Service, Social Security Administration, the DMV of any particular state, and so on, are safe from prying eyes. Maybe they're a little safer now than they used to be, though I doubt it. But in my day, getting any information I wanted was a pushover. I compromised the Social Security Administration, for example, through an elaborate social engineering attack. It began with my usual research, the various departments of the agency, where they were located, who the supervisors and managers were for each, standard internal lingo, and so on. Claims were processed by special groups called MODs, which I think stood for modules, each one perhaps covering a series of Social Security numbers. I social engineered the phone number for a MOD and eventually reached a staff member who told me her name was Anne. I told her I was Tom Harmon in the agency's Office of the Inspector General. I said, "We're going to be needing assistance on a continuing basis," explaining that while our office was working on a number of fraud investigations, we didn't have access to MCS, short for Modernized Claims System, the amusingly clumsy name for their centralized computer system. From the time of that initial conversation, we became telephone buddies. I was able to call Anne and have her look up whatever I wanted: Social Security numbers, dates and places of birth, mother's maiden names, disability benefits, wages, and so on. Whenever I phoned, she would drop whatever she was doing to look up anything I asked for. Anne seemed to love my calls. She clearly enjoyed playing deputy to a man from the Inspector General's office who was doing these important investigations of people committing fraud. I suppose it broke the routine of a mundane, plodding workday. She would even suggest things to search. Would knowing the parents' names help? And then she'd go through a series of steps to dig up the information. On one occasion, I slipped, asking, "What's the weather like there today?" But I supposedly worked in the same city she did. She said, "You don't know what the weather is?" I covered quickly, "I'm in L.A. today on a case." She must have figured, oh, of course, he has to travel for his work. We were phone buddies for about 3 years, both enjoying the banter and the sense of accomplishment. If we had ever met in person, I would have given her a kiss to thank her for all the wonderful help she gave me. Anne, if you're listening to this, your kiss is waiting. I guess real detectives must have a lot of different leads to follow up when they're working on a case, and some of the leads it just takes time to get to. I hadn't forgotten that Eric's apartment rental contract was in the name of a Joseph Wernley. I just hadn't pursued that lead yet. This was one of the several times while playing detective that I would turn to my Social Security chum, Anne. She went on the MCS and pulled up an Alpha Dent file. used to find a person's social security number from his or her name and date of birth. I then asked for a numident to get my subject's place and date of birth, father's name, and mother's maiden name. Joseph Wernley had been born in Philadelphia to Joseph Wernley Sr. and his wife, Mary Eberly, and then ran a DEQY, or DEQY, for me, a detailed earnings query, giving a person's work history and earnings record. Huh? What the hell? Joseph Wernley Jr. was 40 years old, according to his Social Security records. He had never earned a penny. He had never even held a job. What would you have thought at this point? The man existed because Social Security had a file on him, but he had never had a job and never earned an income. The more I dug into his background, the more intriguing the whole thing seemed to get. It didn't make sense, which just made me all the more determined to find out what the explanation could be. But at least now I had his parents' names. This was like playing Sherlock Holmes. Joseph Wernley Jr., the son, had been born in Philadelphia. Maybe his parents still lived there, or at least somewhere nearby. A call to directory assistance for the 215 area code, which covered Philadelphia as well as, back then, surrounding areas of Pennsylvania, turned up three men named Joseph Wernley. I started calling the numbers the directory assistance operator gave me. On my second try, a man answered. I asked if he was Mr. Wernley, and he said yes. "This is Peter Browley with the Social Security Administration," I began. "I was wondering if I could take a few minutes of your time." "What's this about?" "Well, we've been paying Social Security benefits to a Joseph Wernley, and somehow the records appear to have gotten mixed up in our system. It seems we may have been paying the benefits to the wrong person." I paused to let that sink in and let him squirm a little, so I would have him at a bit of a disadvantage. He waited without saying anything. I went on. "Is your wife's name Mary Eberly?" "No," he said. "That's my sister." "Well, do you have a son named Joseph?" "No." After a moment, he added, "Mary has a son named Joseph Ways, but it couldn't be him. He lives in California." This was coming together. Now we were getting somewhere. But there was more. The man on the other end of the phone line was still talking. "He's an FBI agent." Son of a bitch! There was no such person as Joseph Wernley Jr. An FBI agent named Joseph Ways had adopted a false identity using real family names that he could easily remember, and that agent was passing himself off as a hacker named Eric Hines. Or at least that was the most likely deduction, based on what I now knew. The next time I tried to call Eric on his landline telephone, the number was disconnected. Earlier in my hacking career, there had been a point when I had decided it might come in handy sometime to have access to another of the Los Angeles area's utility companies, the Department of Water and Power, or DWP. Everybody needs water and electricity, so the utility company seemed like an extremely valuable source for finding out someone's address. The DWP maintained a unit known as Special Desk to handle calls from law enforcement, staffed by people trained to verify that every caller was on the list of people authorized to receive customer information. I called the DWP corporate offices claiming to be a cop and explained that our sergeant, who had the phone number for Special Desk, was on assignment, and we needed to get it again. I was given it without a problem. Next, I called LAPD's Elite SIS Division. It seemed only fair to include these guys in the fun since they were the ones who had tailed Lenny and me at Pierce College several years earlier. I asked to speak to a sergeant, and I.C. Davidson came on the line. I remember his name well since I continued to use it for a long time whenever I needed information from the DWP. Telling him, "Sergeant, I'm with DWP Special Desk," I said, "we're setting up a database of authorized people for law enforcement requests, and I'm calling to find out if any officers in your division still need access to Special Desk." He said, "Absolutely." I started out as usual by asking if he was on the list and getting his name. "Okay, how many officers do you have who need to be on the list?" He gave me a number. "Okay, go ahead and give me their names, and I'll make sure they're all authorized for another year." It was important for his people to have access to the information from the DWP, so he took the time to patiently read off and spell out the names for me. Some months later, Special Desk added a password to its verification process. No problem. I called up LAPD's Organized Crime Unit and got a lieutenant on the phone. Introducing myself as Jerry Spencer with Special Desk, I chose as my opening gambit a slightly different version of the earlier one. "By the way, are you authorized for a Special Desk?" He said he was. "Fine. What's your name, sir?"
"Billingsley. David Billingsley."
"Hold on while I look you up on the list." I paused a bit and rustled some papers. Then I said, "Oh, yes, your password is 0128.
"No, no, no, my password is 6E2H.
"Oh, I'm sorry, that's a different David Billingsley." I could hardly keep from laughing. I then had him look up the list of officers authorized for Special Desk in the Organized Crime Unit and tell me their names and passwords. At that point, I was golden forever. I wouldn't be surprised if some of those passwords still worked today. With this access to DWP Special Desk, it took me only about 5 minutes to discover Eric's new address. He had moved to a different apartment in the same building. Lewis and I had shown up at his address, and 3 weeks later, he's not living in the same apartment anymore and has a new phone number, but he's in the same building? And the new phone line is listed in the same name as before, Joseph Wernley. If Eric had really gone into secure mode, as he told us he was going to do, why the hell would he still be using the same name? This was the guy who was supposed to be such a good hacker? He didn't seem to have any idea of what I'd be able to find out about him. I was still a long way from unraveling all the riddles, but I knew I had to continue now that I was getting closer and closer to the truth. 20. Reverse Sting. The California Department of Motor Vehicles would turn out to be one of my greatest sources of information, and also, later on, the source of one of my narrowest escapes. How I got access to the DMV is a story in itself. First step, find out what phone number the cops used for official calls to the DMV. I phoned the Orange County Sheriff's Station, asked for the teletype unit, and told the deputy who answered, "I need the DMV number to find out about a Soundex I requested a couple of days ago." In DMV terminology, curiously, when you want a copy of someone's driver's license photo, what you ask for is a Soundex.
"Who are you?" he asked. "This is Lieutenant Moore," I said. "I was calling 916-657-8823, but that number doesn't seem to work anymore." Three things were pulling in my favor here. First, I had reached the deputy on an internal number that he would presume wasn't available to anybody outside the sheriff's department. Second, taking a small but reasonable gamble, I had given him a wrong phone number with what I was almost certain was the correct area code and prefix because, at the time, as I noted earlier, the DMV was assigned the entire 657 prefix, making it highly likely that the number used by law enforcement would also be a 916-657-XXXX number. The deputy would notice that I had everything right except the last four digits. And third, I had elevated myself to the rank of lieutenant. People in a police department or a sheriff's outfit think like people in the military. Nobody wants to say no to somebody with bars on his shoulders. He gave me the correct phone number. Next, I needed to know how many phone lines there were in the office that handled law enforcement calls and the phone number for each line. I had found out that the state of California used a telephone switch from Northern Telecom, the DMS 100. I called the state of California telecommunications department and said I needed to talk to a technician who worked with the DMS 100 switch. The technician I was transferred to accepted my claim that I was with Northern Telecom's Technical Assistance Support Center in Dallas, so I launched into my spiel. In the current release of the software, we have an intermittent issue where calls get routed to the wrong number. We've come up with a patch. It's a small fix, and you won't have any problems with it. But in our customer support database, I can't find the dial-up number to your switch. Now I was down to the tricky part. I like to get this piece of it done by using wording that left the other person no opportunity to object. I said, "So what's the dial-in number, and when's a good time to apply the patch?" The tech was glad to give me the dial-in number to the switch so he wouldn't have to do the update himself. Even in those days, some telephone switches, like corporate computer systems, were password protected. The default account name was all too easy to figure out. NTAS, the abbreviation for Northern Telecom Assistance Support. I dialed the number the technician had given me, entered the account name, and started trying passwords. NTAS? Nope. Update? Nothing doing. How about patch? No luck. So I tried one that I had found being used on Northern Telecom switches for other regional Bell operating companies. Helper. Jackpot. Because Northern Telecom had wanted to make things easy for its own support technicians, every switch was accessible using the same support password. How stupid is that? But great for me. With the account name and password, I now had full access to the switch, and I had gained control of all the phone numbers belonging to the DMV in Sacramento. From my computer, I queried the phone number I had been given for law enforcement access and found that the unit, in fact, had 20 lines in a hunt group, meaning that when the number given out to cops was in use, the next call would automatically roll over to the next available number in the group of 20. The switch would simply hunt for the next line that wasn't busy. I decided to set myself up with the 18th number on the list, because with a high number, I would get calls only when they were very busy, while with a low number, I'd likely be bothered with calls almost nonstop. I entered commands on the switch to add the call forwarding feature and then to actively forward calls that came in on that line so they would instead be routed to my cloned cell phone. I guess not everybody would have the guts I had in those days. Calls started coming in from the Secret Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the DEA, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And get this, I even fielded calls from FBI agents, guys who had the authority to put me in handcuffs and send me back to jail. Each time one of these folks called, thinking he was talking to somebody at the DMV, I would ask for the list of required credentials, name, agency, requester code, driver's license, date of birth, and so on. But I wasn't really risking anything since none of them had any clue that the guy on the other end of the line wasn't really with the DMV. I'll admit when one of these calls would come in, especially from someone in law enforcement, I'd usually answer it, suppressing a grin. Once I got one of these calls when I was having lunch with three others at Bob Burns, a classy steakhouse in Woodland Hills. I shushed everyone at the table when my cell phone rang, and they all looked at me like, "What's your problem?" Then they heard me answer, "DMV, how can I help you?" Now they were swapping "What's Mitnick up to now?" looks. Meanwhile, I was listening and drumming on the table with the fingers of my left hand to make it sound like I was typing on a keyboard. The other people at the table were slowly catching on, their jaws dropping open. Once I'd gotten enough sets of credentials, I dialed back into the switch, temporarily deactivating the call forwarding until the next time I needed more credentials. Finally cracking the DMV put a big smile on my face. It was a super valuable tool that was to come in very handy later on. But I was still desperate to figure out how much the feds knew, what evidence they had, how much trouble I was in, and if there was any way for me to get out of it. Could I still save my ass? I knew it would be stupid to keep up my investigation of Eric. Yet, as so often in the past, I was intrigued by the seduction of adventure and intellectual challenge. It was a puzzle I needed to solve, and I wasn't going to stop. Mark Kasdan of Teltech called and invited me to have lunch with him and Michael Grant, the son part of the father-son team that owned the company. I joined Mark and Michael at a Coco's restaurant near their offices. Michael was a pudgy man who seemed very pleased with himself, to the point of being a bit cocky. The two found it entertaining to draw me into telling stories about my experiences. I made it clear how successful I had been at social engineering, which they also used, though they called it gagging. They were impressed that I knew as much as I did about computers and especially about the phone company. They were even more impressed by my vast experience in tracking down people's addresses, phone numbers, and so on. Finding people seemed to be an important part of their business, a process they referred to as a locate. After lunch, they took me to their offices on the second floor of a building in a strip mall. There was an entry area complete with a receptionist, then a set of individual offices for each of the three PIs and three bosses. A day or two later, Mark dropped by my dad's to tell me, "We want you to come work for us." The salary wasn't anything to brag about, but it was plenty enough to live on. They gave me the title of researcher so as not to raise any suspicions with my probation officer. I was given my own small office, about as sparse as it could be. Desk, chair, computer, and phone. No books, no decorations, completely bare walls. I found Michael to be intelligent, someone I could easily talk to, Our conversations often boosted my self-esteem because when I showed him things I could do that his other employees couldn't, he would reward me by expressing his admiration at a wow factor level. What Mark and Michael wanted me to focus on first was a situation they told me they didn't understand. Those phone taps I had uncovered on Teltech's lines. Why in the world would law enforcement be suspicious of anything they were doing? They had the names of two people they thought might be working the case from the other side, Detective David Simon with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and Daryl Santos of Pacific Bell Security. "Do you know how to tap the detective's phone?" one of my bosses asked. I said, "Sure, but that's too risky." "Well, see what you can find out about this investigation," I was told. I would discover, in time, what the Teltech honchos were hiding from me. The detective had led a team that had raided the PI firm a few months earlier for using unauthorized passwords to access TRW credit reports. Good thing I wasn't willing to investigate a cop, but taking on Pac Bell Security was a different story. It sounded like a fun test of my ingenuity, a challenge I might thoroughly enjoy.
21. Cat and Mouse.
Since Lewis had cut way back on his hacking time to keep Bonnie happy, I fell into hacking with a buddy of his. Terry Hardy was definitely not your everyday sort of guy. Tall and with a high forehead, he talked in a monotone, like a robot. We nicknamed him Klingon after the race of aliens in Star Trek because we thought he shared some of their physical characteristics. A variety of savant, he could carry on a conversation looking you in the eye while at the same time typing 85 words a minute on the computer. It was incredible to watch and distinctly unnerving. One day when Terry, Lewis, and I were with Dave Harrison at Dave's office, I said, "Hey, let's see if we can get Daryl Santos's voicemail password. This could be a way of proving myself to the people at Teltech, if I could actually pull it off." I called the frame that served the telephone numbers at the offices of Pac Bell Security and had the tech look up the cable and pair for a phone number I gave him, the number for Pac Bell Security investigator Daryl Santos. My goal was to get an SAS connection put up on Santos's line, but I wanted it done in a special way. From my research into SAS, I had learned about something called an SAS shoe, a physical connection that had the advantage of letting you drop in on a line and stay on, listening to any calls the subscriber made or received. And with this method, there was no audible click on the line when the SAS connection was established. What would the tech have thought if he'd known that the phone tap he was setting up was on a line belonging to Pac Bell Security? My timing couldn't have been better. As soon as I popped onto the line, I heard a recorded female voice saying, "Please enter your password." Terry Hardy happened to be next to me at the time. Another of his unusual abilities was that he had perfect pitch, or at least some variety of that rare aptitude. He could listen to the touch tones of a phone number being keyed in and tell you what number had just been called. I shouted across the room for Lewis and Dave to be quiet, then said, "Terry, listen. Listen." He got closer to the speakerphone just in time to hear the touch tones as Santos entered his voicemail password. Terry just stood there as if lost in thought. For maybe 20 seconds I didn't dare interrupt. Then, "I think it's 1313, he said. For the next 2 or 3 minutes we all three stood there frozen while Santos, and the four of us, listened to his voicemail messages. After he hung up, I called his voicemail access number and entered 1313 as his password. It worked. We were stoked. Dave, Lewis, Terry, and I all jumped around high-fiving one another. Terry and I went through the same process and eventually got Lily Creek's voicemail password as well. I began making it a daily routine to check both their voicemails, always after hours, when I could be fairly certain they wouldn't be trying to call in at the same time themselves. Getting a message that their voicemail box was in use would be a huge red flag. Over the next several weeks, I listened to a series of messages left by Detective Simon, updating Santos on his investigation of Teltech. It was reassuring for my bosses to know that the detective wasn't coming up with anything new. In another one of those improbable small-world coincidences, Detective Simon, still with the L.A. Sheriff's Department, now as a reserve chief, is the twin brother of my co-author, Bill Simon. In the middle of all this, every now and then I'd recall that tantalizing piece of information I'd been given about one of the charges against Kevin Poulsen for a hack that Eric said he had taken part in, the radio contest that had supposedly won Eric a Porsche and Poulsen himself two more. At other odd moments, I'd remember the contest I'd heard on the radio while driving to Vegas that dreary day not long after my half-brother's death. Finally, those two items collided in my brain. Eric had told Lewis and me that Poulsen's radio contest gambit was based on hacking into the phone company's switch at the central office that handled the radio station's lines. I thought there might be a way to do the same kind of thing without even having to mess with the switch. KRTH broadcast from offices not too far from Dave's, and both were served by the same central office. To start, I'd need a phone number other than the 800 number the disc jockey gave out on the air. Calling an internal department at Pac Bell, I asked for the POTS number for the 800 number. POTS stands for, are you ready for this? Plain Old Telephone Service. It's a standard everyday term used around the phone company. I needed the POTS number because the 800 number used for the radio contest had a choke placed on it, limiting the flow of calls that could come in from each part of the station's broadcast area, and my plan wouldn't work if any of my calls were being choked. The lady I was talking to didn't even ask what my name was or whether I worked for Pacific Bell. She just gave me the number. At Dave Harrison's, I programmed the speed calling feature on four of his phone lines, so that all I had to do to dial directly into the POTS number at the radio station was press 9#. I was counting on the fact that calls routed through the 800 number would take just a bit longer to connect. Then, too, the numbers for Dave's office were switched through the same central office as the station's POTS number, meaning that our calls would be completed instantaneously. But would those minuscule advantages, plus using multiple telephone lines, be enough to make a difference? Once this was all set up, Lewis, Terry, Hardy, Dave, and I each sat at a phone, ready to call. We could hardly wait for the contest to be announced. Caller number 7 was always the winner. We just had to keep calling in until one of us was the 7th caller. As soon as we heard the cue to start calling, the jingle, the best oldies on radio, we quickly punched in 9#. Every time we got through and heard the DJ say, your caller number blank and give a number less than 7, we'd disconnect and quickly dial 9# again, over and over. The third time I speed dialed, I heard, your caller number 7. I shouted into the phone, I won! No way, I won? Are you kidding me? I can't believe it, I never win anything! We all stood up and high-fived. The prize was $1,000, and we'd agreed to share it. Whenever any of us won, we'd put our winnings in the pot. After our first 4 wins, we knew the system was working, but we faced a new challenge. The radio station rules said that no one person could win the contest more than once a year. We started offering a deal to family, friends, and anyone else we knew well enough to think we could trust. When the check arrives, you keep 400 for yourself and pass the other 600 along to us. Over the next 3 or 4 months, we won that contest about 50 times. In the end, we stopped only because we ran out of friends. It's a shame Facebook didn't exist yet. We would have had a lot more friends to work with. The real beauty of it was that it wasn't even illegal. I confirmed with an attorney that as long as we weren't illegally accessing phone company equipment or using a friend's identity without permission, it wasn't fraud. Even when I first got the POTS number, I didn't misrepresent myself as a phone company employee. I just asked for the number and the lady gave it to me. Technically, we were obeying the rules of the game as well. The radio station had a rule that a person could win only once per year. We abided by that. We were simply exploiting a loophole. We never broke any of the rules. Once I surprised myself by taking a long shot. The station provided a phone number you could call to listen to its shows over the telephone. I called in from my mom's living room in Las Vegas, and when the contest came on, I called in, not really imagining I could reach the station just in time to be caller number 7. But then I heard the magic words, the congratulations, followed by the announcers asking, "What's your name?" I hemmed and hawed until I thought of a friend we hadn't used yet. I gave his name and covered the awkward pause by blurting out, I'm so excited I could hardly say my own name. The 4 of us each cleared nearly $7,000 from the whole thing. At one point, When I met Lewis in a restaurant and gave him his share, it was such a lot of cash that I felt like I was making a payoff in a drug deal or something. I used a big chunk of my share to buy my first state-of-the-art laptop, a Toshiba T4400SX, featuring a 486 processor that ran at what was then an impressive speed, a snappy 25 megahertz. I paid $6,000, and that was the wholesale price. It was a sad day when we ran out of people we could trust to cooperate. One night, not long after we got into the radio contest business, I was driving back to my dad's apartment when an idea popped into my head. A scheme that might give me some breathing room while I tried to get to the bottom of the Eric Hines, Mike Martinez, Joseph Wernley, Joseph Ways mystery. My idea was that Lewis would casually, in passing, let slip a piece of information about me to Eric. He'd say something like, "Kevin is thinking about working with some hackers in Europe. He's sure this is going to make him very rich." What I figured was this. Whatever the feds already had on me would seem like small beans next to the prospect of catching me red-handed in the middle of a big hack, stealing a load of dollars or Swiss francs or Deutschmarks from some financial institution or corporation. They would want to keep close tabs on me, but would be willing to wait patiently until I had pulled off this big one, anticipating how they'd swoop in, recover the money, and parade me in handcuffs before the hungry media people and the hungry for scandal public. The FBI saving America from another villain. And while they were waiting for me to arrange the hack, I hoped my supervised release would come to an end. It seemed like a great delaying action to buy myself some extra time. Lewis's attorney, David Roberts, couldn't see anything wrong with this plan. Lewis and I met and discussed the details with him on several occasions. It wouldn't be a violation of any law for Lewis to tell this lie because he wouldn't be telling it directly to a federal agent. My supervised release was due to end in another several months. By the time the feds finally lost patience with waiting for my European hack to happen, those months would have passed, and it would be too late for them to simply pick me up and ship me back to prison for violating the terms of my release. Would they really wait that long? I could only hope so. Lewis reported a couple of days later that he had mentioned my big European hack to Eric, who had pressed him for details. Lewis told him that I had said it was so big I didn't want to tell him any more about it. Spring had turned into summer, and I was beginning to feel settled in as a Los Angelino once again. But my living arrangements needed some attention. At first, moving in with my dad had felt like a way to begin making up for all those years when he was living 2,000 miles away and building a life with a new family. I had taken over Adam's room partly out of a sense of wanting to help my dad and be with him in that difficult time after Adam's death, and because I was hoping we would become closer. But it hadn't worked out, as I had hoped, not by a mile. We had some good times together, but we also had long stretches that felt more like my early years, when our relationship was a battlefield covered with landmines. We all make concessions when we live with others, and though it's a cliche, it's also true that we don't get to pick our relatives. But somewhere there's a line in the sand between what we choose to ignore and put up with and what makes the days seem just too annoying. As various women in my life have made perfectly clear, I'm not so easy to live with myself, so I'm sure the fault here wasn't all on one side. It finally got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore, irked by my dad's frequent complaints that I spent too much time on the phone, but even more irked by his fetish for precision. I like to live in a clean and straightened up place, but for him it was an obsession. If you remember Felix, the character in The Odd Couple, played by Jack Lemmon in the movie and Tony Randall on television, you'll recall that he was a neat freak with an obsessive aversion to the least disarray. Felix was a pussycat compared with my dad. One example will prove my point. My father actually used a tape measure to make sure that the hangers in his closet were evenly spaced at exactly 1 inch apart. Now, multiply that fussiness and apply it to every detail in a 3-bedroom apartment, and you'll begin to understand the sort of nightmare I was living. In the spring of 1992, I gave up and decided to move out. I was happy to stay in the same complex, close enough to see my dad regularly, but not so close that I was still living under his thumb. I didn't want Dad to think I was turning my back on him. I was stunned when the lady in the rental office told me there was a waiting list and it might be a couple of months before a unit became available for me. Thankfully, I wasn't stuck at my dad's. Teltech's Mark Kasdan agreed to let me move into his guest bedroom until my name came to the top of the waiting list for a unit of my own. After I settled into my new digs, I embarked on another counter-surveillance project. From Dave Harrison's office using my new laptop, I decided to see what I could pick up by using SAS to listen in on the phone conversations of Pacific Bell's manager of security, John Venn. I popped onto Venn's line every now and then. Usually when I stumbled across a call in progress, it was about nothing of much interest and I'd only half listen while doing something else. But one day, that summer, I popped in on his line when he was in the middle of a conference call with several colleagues. If this were a scene in a movie, you'd probably groan because the chance of it's really happening would seem so remote. It really did happen, though. My ears pricked up when one of the men mentioned Mitnick. The conversation was fascinating, revealing, and encouraging. It turned out these guys had no idea how I was defeating all their systems and traps, and that really irritated them. They talked about needing ideas about how they might be able to set a trap for me, something that would give them hard evidence against me that they could then turn over to the FBI. They were wondering what I might try next so they could have something in place to catch me red-handed. Somebody suggested a plot for trapping me that was way stupid. I was dying to bust into their conversation and say, "I don't think that would work. This Mitnick guy is pretty clever. You never know. He could be listening to us right now." Yes, I had done other things every bit as gutsy and reckless as that, but this time I managed to resist the temptation. On the other hand, I was less resistant to doing something gutsy when asked by someone in need. One Thursday at the beginning of June, on a day when I hadn't gone into work because I had some errands I needed to do, I got a frantic phone call from Mark Kasdan. Armand Grant, the head of Teltech, had just been arrested. His son, Michael, and Kasdan were trying to raise bail, but they'd been told it might take as much as a day and a half after they posted bail before he would be released. I said, "No problem. Let me know when that's done, because once he gets bail, I'll get him walked out of there in about 15 minutes. Kasdan said, "That's impossible." But knowing how law enforcement people respected rank, I just called another jail in northern Los Angeles, Wayside, and asked, "Who's the lieutenant on duty there this afternoon?" They gave me his name. Then I called the men's central jail where Grant was being held. I already knew the direct dial internal number for the warrants division. When a lady answered, I asked for the extension at receiving and discharge. For somebody like me, in a situation like this, there were advantages in my actually having been through the jail system. I told her I was Lieutenant so-and-so, using the name I had just been given, at Wayside. "You have an inmate whose bail is supposed to be posted. He's working as an informant on a case for us, and I need to get him out immediately," and gave her Grant's name. The sound of computer keys came over the telephone. "We just got the order, but we haven't entered it yet." I said I wanted to talk to her sergeant. When he came on the line, I gave him the same pitch and said, "Sergeant, can you do me a personal favor?"
"Yes, sir," he said. "What do you need?"
"Once the man's bond is posted, can you personally walk him through the whole process and get him out as soon as possible?" He answered,
"No problem, sir."
I got a call from Michael Grant 20 minutes later to say that his father was out. 22. Detective work. If I could help Grant with so little effort, how come I still didn't have the lowdown on Wernley? Fortunately, I was about to unlock that secret. Eric kept talking about having to go to work, but he would always change the subject whenever I asked what he did. So who was signing his paychecks? Maybe hacking into his bank account would give me the answer. Since Eric's name wasn't on his rental application or any of his utility bills, I'd look for an account in the Wernley name. What bank was he using? Banks, of course, guard their customer information carefully, but they also need to ensure that authorized employees are able to obtain information from different branches. In those days, most banks used a system that allowed an employee to identify himself to a fellow employee at another branch by providing a code that changed every day. For example, Bank of America used 5 daily codes labeled A, B, C, D, and E. each of which was assigned a different four-digit number. An employee calling another branch for information would be challenged to give the correct number for code A or code B or whatever. This was the banking industry's idea of foolproof security. With reverse social engineering, I easily got around it. My plan had several layers. First thing in the morning, I'd call the target branch, ask for someone in the new accounts department, and pretend to be a potential customer with a substantial sum of money who had questions about the best way to earn maximum interest. After developing a rapport, I'd say I had to go to a meeting but could call back later. I'd ask the account rep's name and say, "When are you going to lunch?" "I'm Jeanette," she might say. "I'll be here until 12:30. I'd wait till after 12:30, then call back again and ask for Jeanette. When I was told she was out, I'd introduce myself and say I was from another of the bank's branches. "Jeanette called me earlier," I'd explain, "and said she needed this customer information faxed to her, but I've got to go to a doctor's appointment shortly. Can I just fax this over to you instead?" The colleague would say that was no problem and give me the fax number. "Great," I'd say. "I'll send it right over. Oh, but first, can you give me the code of the day?" "But you called me," the banker would exclaim. "Well, yeah, I know, but Jeanette called me first, and you know our policy requiring the code for the day before sending customer information," I'd bluff. If the person objected, I'd say I couldn't send the information, and I'd continue with something like, "In fact, please let Jeanette know I couldn't send her what she needed because you wouldn't verify the code. Also, please let her know that I'll be out of the office until next week, and we can discuss it when I get back." That was usually enough to push the holdout over the edge because no one would want to undermine a coworker's request. So then I'd say, "Okay, what's code E?" He'd give me code E, which I would file in my memory. "Nope, that's not it," I'd tell him. "What? You said 6214? That's not right," I'd insist. "Yes, that's code E," the banker would say. "No, I didn't say E. I said B." And then he'd give me the code B. I now had a 40% chance of getting the information I wanted any time I called any branch of that bank for the rest of the day, since I knew two of the five codes. If I talked to someone who seemed to be a real pushover, I'd go for another one and see if he or she would go along. A few times I even managed to get three of the codes in a single call. It helped, too, that the letters B, D, and E all sound sort of alike. If I called a bank and was asked for code A when I only had B and E, I'd just say, "Oh, listen, I'm not at my desk right now. Would you settle for B or E?" These conversations were always so friendly that the bank employees would have no reason to doubt me. And because they didn't want to seem unreasonable, they'd usually just agree. If not, I'd simply say I was going back to my desk to get code A. I'd call back later in the day to talk to a different employee. For Wernley, I tried this first on Bank of America. The ruse worked, but there was no customer with Joseph Wernley's social security number. So how about Wells Fargo? A little easier. I didn't need a code since Danny Yellen, one of the investigators at Teltech, had a friend named Greg who worked there. Because the phone lines were monitored, Danny and Greg had set up their own personal code, which they now shared with me. I'd call Greg and chat with him about going to the ball game that weekend or whatever, then say something like, "If you want to join us, just call Kat and she'll get a ticket for you." Kat was the flag. It meant I wanted the code of the day. He'd answer, "Great, is she still at 310-725-1866? "No," I'd say and give him a different number just for the confusion factor. The last four digits of the fake phone number he had given me was the code for the day. Once I had the code, I'd phone a branch and say I was calling from branch number so-and-so. "We're having some computer issues. It's so slow I can't get anything done. Can you look something up for me?" "What's the code of the day?" For my Wernley search, I gave the code and said something like, "I need you to bring up a customer account." "What's the account number?" "Search on the customer's social," and I provided Wernley's social security number. After a moment, she said, "Okay, I've got two." I had her give me the numbers of both accounts and the balances. The first part of the account number indicated the branch where the account was located. Wernley's were both at the Tarzana branch in the San Fernando Valley. A call to that branch with a request to pull Wernley's signature card, put me in position to ask a key question I'd been longing to have answered. "Who's the employer?" Alta Services, 18663 Ventura Boulevard. When I called Alta Services and asked for Joseph Wernley, I got a chilly, "He's not in today." It sounded suspiciously as if the next sentence might have been, "And we're not expecting him." The rest was made to order in this era of your banking information at your fingertips. With Wernley's account number and the last four digits of his social in hand, I simply placed a phone call to the bank's automated system and had it feed me back all the details I could want about his banking transactions. What I learned only deepened the mystery. Joseph Wernley often had funds flowing into and out of his accounts totaling thousands of dollars every week. Wow, what could this mean? I couldn't imagine. If he was running all this money through his bank account, I figured maybe his tax return would give me some useful clues about what was really going on. I had learned that I could get taxpayer information from the Internal Revenue Service easily enough, just by social engineering employees who had computer access. The IRS complex in Fresno, California had hundreds of phone lines. I'd call one at random, armed with foreknowledge based on my usual brand of research. I'd say something like, "I'm having problems getting into IDRS. Is yours working?" IDRS stands for Integrated Data Retrieval System. Of course, her or his terminal was working, and almost always the person was gracious about taking time out to help a fellow employee. This time when I gave the Social Security number for Wernley, the agent told me his tax returns for the most recent 2 years available on their system showed no reportable income. Well, that figured, in one sense at least. I already knew his Social Security records showed no earned income. Now the IRS was offering confirmation. An FBI agent who paid no Social Security and no income taxes, yet routinely had thousands of dollars passing through his bank accounts. What was that about? How does that old line go? Something like, "The only things certain in life are death and taxes." It was beginning to sound as if, for an FBI agent, the part about taxes didn't apply. I tried to call Eric and found that his new line wasn't working any longer. I tried his second line. Same story. A social engineering call to the rental office in his building produced the information that he had moved out. No, he hadn't moved to a different apartment in the same complex like the previous time. He had moved out completely. The rental lady looked up his information for me, but as I suspected, he had not left a forwarding address. Back to DWP Special Desk once again. This was a long shot, but a place to begin. I asked the clerk to look up any new service for last name Wernley. It took her only a moment. "Yes," she said, "I have a new account for Joseph Wernley," and she gave me an address on McCadden Place in Hollywood. I couldn't believe the feds were lame-brained enough to keep using the same name on the public utilities accounts for a guy they were trying to hide. I had Eric's pager number. That number still worked, and it told me which pager company was providing him with service. I called and tricked an account rep into revealing the specific number that made Eric's pager distinct from every other. It's CAP, Channel Access Protocol Code. Then I went out and bought a pager from the same company, telling the clerk that I'd dropped my previous one in the toilet while I was peeing. He laughed sympathetically. He'd obviously heard the story before from people it had really happened to, and had no problem programming the new one with the CAP code I gave him. From then on, whenever someone from the FBI or anyone else paged Eric or sent him a pager text, I would see the message on my cloned pager exactly as it appeared on his. What were the odds of my intercepting two telephone conversations in close succession and hearing about myself both times? Not long after listening to the crew from Pacific Bell Security worrying over how to booby-trap me, I got another earful. I hadn't tried wiretapping Eric because he knew we had access to SAS, and I was worried that the frame techs might have been instructed to call Pacific Bell Security or the FBI if anyone tried to attach equipment to his line. Eric thought he had a safeguard against my listening to his phone calls. He'd played with SAS enough to know that you hear a very distinct click when somebody used it to drop in on your line. But he didn't know about making a connection with a SAS shoe, which, as I've explained, was a direct connection, using a cable that the frame technician placed directly on the customer's cable and pair, and so produced no audible click on the line. By chance, I went up on Eric's line one day using a SAS shoe and heard him in conversation with someone he was calling Ken. I didn't have to wonder who Ken was. FBI Special Agent Ken McGuire. They were talking about what evidence Ken needed for getting a search warrant on Mitnick. The call threw me into an intense panic. I began to wonder if they were following me or even preparing to arrest me. Eric didn't sound like an undercover informant. Instead, his calling McGuire Ken sounded like one agent talking to another, with McGuire, the older, more experienced agent, leading the more junior agent to a better understanding of what they needed to get a search warrant.
Search warrant. Evidence against Mitnick. Holy shit, I thought. Again, I would have to get rid of every scrap of evidence that could be used against me.
As soon as they hung up, I immediately reprogrammed my phone, cloning it to a different phone number, one I had never used before. Then I called Lewis at work.
Emergency, I told him. You've got to go to the payphone outside your office building right now,
just in case the feds were monitoring cell phone transmissions near his workplace. I got in my car and drove to a place that I knew would be covered by a different cell phone tower, again, in case agents were monitoring the one serving the Teltec area. As soon as Lewis answered the payphone, I told him,
"The government has been building a case against us, and Eric is part of it. It's 100% confirmation that we are the targets. Change your number right now."
Oh, shit. That was his only response. "We need to go into cleanup mode," I said. He sounded dejected and scared.
"Yeah, right," he said. "I know what to do."
All the time I had been laboring over my research on Eric, I'd expected to find out he was an FBI snitch, if not an agent. But now that it was certain, I knew this was no game anymore. This was for real. I could almost feel the cold steel of the prison bars. I could almost taste the bland, barely edible prison food. I was waiting at Kasdan's door when he got home from work with boxes of discs that I asked him to store for me. That same evening, I drove over to the home of another friend of my dad's who had agreed to let me park my computer and all my notes with him. DePayne's cleanup wasn't so easy. Something of a pack rat, he had swarms of mess all over his apartment. Digging through the piles to find the items that could help the government build a case against him had to be a huge challenge. And it wasn't something anybody could help him with. He was the only one who knew which hard drives and floppy disks were safe and which could land him in prison. The task took him a couple of full days, the whole time under pressure of what would happen if federal agents showed up before he was finished. I should have been using every resource I had to find out about Eric before this, I knew, but better late than never. I called Anne, my contact at the SSA. She looked up Eric Hines and gave me his social security number, birthplace, and date of birth. She also told me he was listed as receiving disability payments for a missing limb. If this story about his motorcycle crash was true, and he really was walking around on an artificial leg, the doctors must have done some great job because I had never seen even the hint of a limp. Or maybe he wasn't really missing a leg at all, but had just found a doctor to make a phony report so he could collect benefits. That might explain how come he never seemed to go off to a job. I told Anne, "This is a fraud case. Let's see if we can find his parents' names." Eric's driver's license said that he was a junior, which made this step a whole lot easier. She looked up all of the people listed as Eric Hines Sr. with a birth year in the range that I had calculated might be reasonable for Eric's father. She found one with a birth date of June 20th, 1935. That evening, Teltec co-worker Danny Yellen and I met for dinner at Solly's Delicatessen in Sherman Oaks. After we ordered, I went to the payphone and called the number I had tracked down for Eric Hines Sr. What happened next maybe shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. It caught me off guard. "I'm trying to get a hold of Eric," I said. "I'm a friend of his from high school."
"Who is this?" the man asked in a suspicious tone. "What's your name again?"
"Maybe I have the wrong Eric Hines. Is there an Eric Jr.?"
"My son passed away," he said.
He sounded annoyed, bordering on controlled anger. He said he wanted my phone number, that he would call me back, obviously planning to report me to the authorities and have me investigated. No problem. I gave him the number for the payphone in the deli and hung up. He called back